It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, we're happy to have Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Evan Renfro is with us as well of the University of Northern Iowa, Assistant Professor of Political Science there. Also, for our discussions today, important for you to note that he's a former U.S. Air Force Intelligence Analyst and a Senior Civilian Intelligence Analyst. Evan, welcome to you.
Howdy, Ben. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. And we want to invite our listeners as well. We'll be talking a little bit later about the acting Navy Secretary resigning after that outcry we've been hearing about in the last few days. We'll get Evan's view as a veteran and former intelligence analyst for the military, but perhaps there are other veterans out there who have been following that story who would like to weigh in. 1-866-780-9100. Call now. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Let's start off with, we wanted to during this hour, get a number of international aspects of the COVID crisis that coming up, how authoritarians are at an advantage, for instance. We'll talk about that later in the hour. But to start our hour off, we have to want to talk about the news that broke within the last hour that the senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, has ended his presidential campaign this morning. This clears the path for Joe Biden's get the Democratic nomination and his showdown with President Trump in November. In announcing this, Wayne, comment, because he said, "We are winning. We are winning the ideological battle," said Sanders today. "And we are winning the support of so many young people and working people throughout the country." Sanders, of course, a big name in 2016, a big surprise in 2016, now in 2020, out of the race. What will you see as his legacy? Definitely moving the Democratic Party to the left, right?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that at all. Clearly, you know, in terms of support for student loans or excusing student loans, sort of whether we get Medicare for all is an open question, but clearly the nature of the debate has shifted dramatically as a result of Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. And a bit of irony, is it not, Wayne, that at the time when health care is the number one story, this COVID crisis may actually change the politics of our national health care?
I suspect that it will, because the costs are going to be enormous. And will private insurance companies be able to even pay the costs without really big raises in the rates that people have to pay? And then what about the people who don't have health care and who can't afford the cost? So I can't imagine that there won't be a major health care debate, no matter who wins the election.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to some so much news just from this week. We won't get to it all, but let's talk about yesterday and the president's comment during yesterday's coronavirus briefing. He threatened to withhold funding from the World Health Organization, accusing it of not having been aggressive enough in confronting the virus. Here's an excerpt from the daily coronavirus briefing at the White House yesterday, the president.
They called it wrong. They call it wrong. They missed the call. They could have called it months earlier. They would have known. And they should have known, and they probably did know. So we'll be looking into that very carefully. And we're going to put a hold on money spent to the WHO. We're going to put a very powerful hold on it, and we're going to see. It's a great thing if it works, but when they call every shot wrong, that's no good.
Okay. You heard the remarks there from yesterday. The president later yesterday denied that he had made those remarks, appeared to back down. Evan, what do you make of this, denouncing the WHO for some of the very missteps and failures that have been leveled at him and his administration by public health experts?
Yeah, right. This is one of those rewriting of history narrative moves that this president is known for. We now know that there was a memo authored by a senior cabinet level official, Pete Navarro, well before this got worse. This was back in January when the president was still comparing this to a seasonal flu. So not only was it untrue that the WHO had downplayed this, but indeed we know that the president's own senior officials had indeed passed memos around trying to get action earlier, way earlier than what ended up happening.
Wayne, can you imagine the logic of the U.S. president attacking the World Health Organization, especially at a time like this?
Well, I think we're getting to the blame-shifting stage of the argument on COVID-19. Who will end up getting the responsibility for the crisis? The WHO is an international organization. Is a natural target. The WHO, in fact, sent warnings out well before Trump sent any kind of warnings out. Taking away funding from the WHO would clearly limit the activities of the most important international organization to grips with the virus, and would clearly debilitate the international effort to limit the spread of COVID-20. So in the process of blaming the WHO for the problem, actually maybe weakening the response or the ability of the international community to respond collectively.
Mm-hmm. Another move by the president yesterday, please comment on this. He moved to oust the leader of this new watchdog panel. This is a panel charged with overseeing how his administration spends the trillions of taxpayer dollars in coronavirus pandemic relief. We have to put this also in context, right? Evan, let me go to you with this, because in recent days, he fired the inspector general who reviewed the whistleblower complaint that led to his impeachment. He nominated a White House aide to another key inspector general post and declared he would ignore certain oversight provisions in this new law that were written in there by Congress, and attacked another inspector general who criticized virus testing shortages. How do you interpret this series of moves, the latest with that head of the new watchdog panel evidently being nixed?
Yes, this definitely fits a pattern. So let me first explain what Inspector General is. That is the ethics watchdog in various U.S. federal departments. Everybody has an IG, and what makes them so powerful is that they sit outside of the normal chain of command. They're tasked with making sure people are acting ethically and there's no fraud, waste, or abuse. Now, in the past 4 days, the president has fired two IGs and expressed displeasure with a third. So he fired the IG for the intelligence community that he explicitly said he was firing him for passing along to Congress the whistleblower complaint about Ukraine. And he's fired the Pentagon's IG, who had been elected by his fellow IGs in the community to serve as head of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. So once you start firing independent watchdogs and filling those with loyalists, well, I think it's predictable what sort of behavior will ensue.
Okay. Another aspect here that we heard from yesterday's news that I wanted to bring out, play a little audio from our neighbor, our big neighbor to the east, Chicago, the mayor. The virus is infecting, evidently, and killing black people in the U.S. at a disproportionately high rate. This, according to data released by several states and big cities, Chicago being one of them. Why should this be? Well, public health researchers say that to blame are the entrenched inequalities in resources, health, and access to care. Donald Trump has acknowledged this disparity. He said that the authorities were working to provide more information. Illinois, 43% of the people who have died from the disease and 28% of those who have tested positive are African Americans. This is a group that makes up just 15% of Illinois' population. Let's listen to Lori Lightfoot in a Monday press conference. The mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, said the numbers take her breath away.
This is a call to action moment. for all of us. When we talk about equity and inclusion, they're not just nice notions. They are an imperative that we must embrace as a city. It's unacceptable. No one should think that this is okay.
Okay. Lori Lightfoot, Mayor of Chicago, Wayne Moyer. Is this any surprise? Do you see implications here of this disparity, this disproportionately high rates among Black people in the U.S.?
I have a couple things to say on this. One, I don't think the federal government has been keeping track up until now in terms of the differences between racial minorities and white people in terms of COVID-19. And it's important that that data be collected. The second thing is my suspicion is that an awful lot of the cases of minority people getting COVID-19, these are people without any kind of health insurance. And without health insurance, they're reluctant to go to the doctor. And as a result of being reluctant to go to the doctor, treatment doesn't start until the disease is far advanced. I suspect that will come out as one of the conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Wayne commented on this earlier, but Evan, to you, implications here? Especially at a time when healthcare is so front and center of our national debate.
Well, I definitely think it will push the political discourse in that direction. You know, pandemics, like wars, often are going to disproportionately affect people from lower socioeconomic social groups, whether that is access to healthcare, underlying health conditions, or purely not having the resources to either move from the area in the case of war or go to the doctor in case of a pandemic. Access, economics, this is all part of healthcare, and I'm sure it will impact heavily the upcoming debates.
Mm-hmm. So healthcare, a major, from what we can tell from this vantage point, still several months away from the November election, Wayne, healthcare a major, if not the major issue, but doesn't it really boil down to now as a referendum on how well Donald Trump is handling this crisis?
Oh, I think Trump's handling of the crisis will be the central issue in the political campaign, and the extent to which he can convince the public at the time of the election that he has acted in an appropriate manner to deal with the crisis. And particularly his actions when the virus first appeared in January, or first appeared publicly in January, where he played down the threat, I think that's going to be right at the center of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa, our two professors of politics, political science at those respective institutions. And Evan, we want to add here because I want to talk about this acting Navy secretary story. Evan, in your background, you are a former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst. Let me just sort of recount what we've been hearing in the news the last few days, starting with yesterday. The acting Navy Secretary, Thomas Maudley, resigned after he faced this mounting backlash for firing. And not only that, but then ridiculing the commander of a U.S. aircraft carrier, the USS Roosevelt, a carrier commander who evidently pleaded for help to stem a coronavirus outbreak on board that aircraft carrier. This is Captain Brett Crozier. He was relieved of command last week by Maudley when Maudley fired him over the leak of a four-page letter. His crew, and you can see this on YouTube, you've probably seen it on your news, thousands of the crew members, and you have to remember this aircraft carrier houses, it's a floating city, 5,000 crew members. They hailed him as a hero when he was departing on Guam after he was relieved of command by the acting Navy Secretary. Then the acting Navy Secretary flies to Guam to castigate the captain in a speech to the crew on Monday. He questioned Crozier's character, saying at one point he was either stupid or naive. After the audio of his speech leaked, which included expletives. Motley initially stood by his remarks, but later, at the defense secretary's request, he issued an apology. Then came yesterday's resignation. Let's hear a little bit of the audio from that captured on board the USS Roosevelt while docked in Guam from the former, now former, acting Navy Secretary Thomas Motley.
And so she's willing to put all that at risk to take care of you guys. And she told me today, when Captain Crozier's letter came out in the public, she had to then deal with all her constituents who were saying, holy crap, what's happening? We're going to have 5,000 people with COVID in our city without health, proper health care and everything else. So think about that. When you cheer the man off the ship who exposed you to that, I understand you love the guy. It's good that you love him, but you're not required to love him.
Okay. Wayne, or let's go to Evan Renfro there. Of course, as a former military person as well, what do you make of this story? What are your thoughts?
Well, this is a shocking turn of events here. I mean, first of all, it's probably helpful to back up and remember how this guy got to be acting Navy Secretary in the first place. He replaced the secretary before him, who had been fired for failing to fall into Trump's narrative on that Navy SEAL who was accused and tried of murdering that individual, if you remember that. So that's how he became acting secretary in the first place. So this aircraft carrier skipper wrote an email to his chain of command, say, we have a COVID outbreak on ship here. I got 5,000 sailors I'm concerned about. These are people's sons and daughters. Can I get some help here? Apparently, the acting secretary flew off the handle, got on his personal VIP jet, flew 8,000 miles from Washington, D.C. to Guam, boarded the aircraft carrier, didn't talk with anybody, didn't meet with any of the sailors. He picked up the PA address system and did this 15-minute profanity-laden, you know, chewing out of these sailors whose jaws just must have been dropped at how bizarre this behavior was. And then he got back on his plane and flew back to D.C. And as you said, he initially said, I stand by every word I said. And he said, well, no, I apologize. Now he's, of course, been asked to – his resignation has been accepted. But this is a maddening situation for those sailors, I'm sure, and their families to be put through this level of discourse and abuse by the most senior civilian official of the Navy. Now, another interesting point here is that the uniformed leadership, that is the admiral in charge of the Navy, the chief of naval operations, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, both made the argument that the skipper here, the Captain Crozier, should be not relieved of duty until at least an investigation took place to see what happened. Mm-hmm. That was overruled by the Secretary of Defense, and that's sort of what led to all this happening.
Mm-hmm. And from what you can tell, the leak of this four-page letter was sent in an unclassified way, I understand, which to many, all to email addresses of people in the Navy, as I understand it, but still, nevertheless, unclassified. We could have assumed that the captain knew that this would leak, and perhaps that was his intention. Shouldn't he be faulted for that?
Well, there was no classified information in this. This is indeed, of course, the story that the former acting secretary was saying is one of the reasons he was so upset. Yeah, indeed, it was used on what we call the Nipper net or the unclassified system, but there was nothing classified in it. You know, they very much wanted to control the narrative here, and it just so happened that a lot of people on board this floating city, this strategically crucial piece of equipment to the United States defense, was covered in COVID. And so you have the ship's skipper asking for help. That is not something that you would typically be relieved for duty for doing, especially, and then he calls him naive and stupid. I mean, this is just bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, your view on this?
Could I just add just a little bit? An aircraft carrier, in a way, is like a cruise ship in terms of the contagiousness of the disease. And you can understand how a captain in those circumstances would want to get the word out as quickly as possible to save the health of his crew members. And sending an unclassified message was probably the fastest way to get that word out, and hence probably would have been the best way to protect the health of the crew.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa. We have a break in a couple minutes. Time enough to take Ann calling from Iowa City, who's been listening to our conversation. Ann, I don't know if you wanted to talk about that or something earlier this half hour. I'll have to ask you to be quick. We've got just a couple minutes before break. What's on your mind? Welcome.
This is Ann from Cedar Rapids, actually.
All right, Ann. Sorry.
What I'd like to comment on is, you know, the ship thing is important, but a bigger topic of discussion that needs to be addressed is Trump's recent firing of two different inspector generals. One, the inspector general who moved the whistleblower complaint up the chain of command. Trump has fired that person last week, and now he's also recently fired Glenn Fine, the inspector general who was nominated by the other IGs to oversee the relief monies being dispersed. President Trump wants somebody in place who will answer to him, Trump, so that there will be no oversight of the disbursement of these monies, so that he can get money to his businesses and to those of his cronies. He is going to fire whoever is elected, whoever is put in place next, until he gets someone who will answer to him and do what he wants. That is an abuse of power. And I would like your experts to please discuss that issue, because that's very important right now.
And I have a feeling you may have joined our conversation a little bit late. We did talk about that approximately 15 minutes ago. We're coming up on a break. And thanks, nevertheless, for your view on that. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we're going to use the international expertise that we have in Wayne and Evan's focus areas as academics there to look at some international aspects of the COVID crisis here. When we come back, we'll talk about how this is working out for authoritarian leaders around the world. It evidently offers, this pandemic offers a convenient way to silence critics and consolidate power. We'll talk about that, ask Wayne and Evan about it when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, just a program note here, I'll be talking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer for the Storm Lake Times, Art Cullen. What a wonderful man and an important bit of work that he's done over the decades, speaking truth to power there. Art Cullen will reflect on how, well, we've known for years it's been a rough time for the newspaper industry. Now the COVID crisis has really been devastating. He'll share his thoughts tomorrow on the program. We'll have a news buzz sort of edition of the program tomorrow. Then Friday, we'll be answering your questions, medical questions, COVID medical questions, also questions regarding financial security. We'll have experts on in both of those areas. And if you'd like to chip in a question, just go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll scroll down quickly and be able to quickly see our COVID live blog, where we have all the updates about the state of the coronavirus epidemic in our state, and also a form there where you can chip in your question at iowapublicradio.org. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa with us this hour. Let's concentrate this half hour more on international politics. Of course, we've been watching the reports of out of the UK, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. According to the BBC report I have on my screen now, Wayne, responding to treatment in intensive care. So he was taken into intensive care the other day. The stats in the UK, a total death toll now at over 7,000 Wayne, to have a world leader such as Boris Johnson struck down by this. We certainly are hoping that that he continues to respond to treatment, but that would be something.
Yeah, I think what we have here is an issue of public perceptions. And when a country feels that it's in crisis or under threat from something, it always wants to rely on its leader. And the sense that your leader is not able to fully function, I'm sure, is having an impact. And I think that's what led the Queen to give her extraordinary, and I thought wonderful, speech the other day to try to unify the British people. Work together. Let's overcome the crisis. We will be able to overcome it. I don't think the actual functioning of the government will be hurt very much, because much of that is done by the bureaucracy and the other members of the cabinet. So I think the government will function fine. I think the problem is public perceptions.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro, let's have you take us to South America, where you suggested that we take a look at Venezuela and Brazil. Recently, the U.S. Justice Department unsealing some criminal charges against the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, also other members of his regime, in alleged for some narco-terrorism, drug smuggling into the U.S. And we remind ourselves that Washington does not consider Maduro to be Venezuela's rightful president, correct?
That's correct. Attorney General Barr released and unsealed the indictments for narco-trafficking, and they've connected it with terrorism by way of FARC operating in Colombia. The argument is they're using both sea and air lanes of traffic to import narcotics into the United States. The U.S. government has now put $15 million out for a reward on Maduro's capture. It'd be unlikely, as long as he stays in Venezuela, he'd be perfectly fine. But if he travels somewhere, certainly somewhere that has treaty obligations with the U.S., he'd be open to arrest on those charges. And then Bolsonaro in Brazil is one of these authoritarian strongmen that are just refusing that COVID-19 is real. He's saying that, look, everybody is going to die someday. You should go out and just live your life. And piggyback off something Wayne was alluding to, in political science we have a term called, or a phrase called, rally around the flag effect, which is to say that in times of national emergency, there's a tendency for citizens to really get behind their leaders, really want their leaders to issue instructions and directions and to believe in your leaders. And that can be good insofar as it helps chaos be put aside and some sort of organized response to the emergency. On the other hand, in the hands of authoritarians or would-be authoritarians, a great advantage can be taken of this human tendency. And so you're seeing that globally, and we can go through and talk about those examples.
Mm-hmm. But in Brazil, this remarkable stance by the president, Bolsonaro, is the population, other politicians, are they going along with his call just to behave as normal, go to work
well,
and everything?
Actually, he's getting some pushback there, even from former allies. The more liberal politicians in Brazil have always been against Bolsonaro and have said, look, COVID is real. But this time you even have explicitly right-wing politicians and allies that are governors and other high-level politicians in the country are saying, no, we do need to stay home. We actually need to take this seriously. So it's interesting about the pushback there.
As we mentioned at the beginning of the hour, I wanted to look through the lens of, through a lens at authoritarian leaders in particular this hour, and how these type of leaders around the world are seeing this pandemic as really an opportunity to what? To silence critics, consolidate power. Wayne and Evan, let's talk about this a little bit more. Evan, start us off. You started there just a moment ago. Name some other countries with autocrats in power that seem to be behaving in the way described.
Right, yeah. So you can sort of go down the list. Everything that would be even funny if it wasn't so dangerous. So in Belarus, you have Lukashenko, who is telling his people, this is no big deal. What you have to do is drink lots of vodka and go to the sauna. All right. Well, and then you can have a more extreme example, the boss, I won't say even the elected official, but this sort of the strong man in Turkmenistan has put out a law where you are liable for arrest if you talk about COVID in public.
Wow.
Putin has, in Russia, has outlawed protests of even one person. So you can't even have a one-person protest now. Orban in Hungary, you get 5 years for spreading fake news about COVID. Well, fake news is defined in whatever way Orban and his cronies want to do it. Same thing in the Philippines under Duterte, Modi's India, Erdogan's Turkey, Xi's China, Khan in Pakistan, al-Sisi in Egypt, I mean Thailand, Cambodia, Bangladesh. This is all about control of free speech, control of the media, of course. Now, they're going to say this is a national emergency. It takes extreme steps. The problem is once these patterns are set and developed, nothing goes back to antebellum or to before prelapsarian times, right, to the way it was before. You know, ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is bliss is not an effective public health strategy here, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Evan Renfro of the University of Northern Iowa, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, if you've joined us on this Politics Wednesday edition, we're focusing our view on international aspects of the COVID pandemic right now. Wayne Moyer, what do you have to add to that? That seems, it's quite a list and quite a theme there that authoritarian leaders would just say, this is perfect to silence my critics, to consolidate power, and also the headlines are full of other things. So why not do it for that reason as well?
Yeah, and I think Evan's covered it pretty thoroughly. But one of the things I think that is most important here is many of these countries, by no means all of them, but many of these countries had democratic elections to bring these people, to their leaders, to power. Hungary's a very good example of that. India's another example of that. And so this not only allows people to increase their power, but in democracies can, in fact, help to undermine the democracy. And once the leaders have consolidated power, then they can fully undermine the democratic process that brought them to power. And that for me, unless there are really strong democratic institutions, that's almost impossible to prevent.
Right. It's, and Wayne, unthinkable when this crisis subsides that any of these autocrats would say, oh, the crisis is for the most part over. Let's go back to the way it was and give you back some of your civil rights.
People who have power never give it up easily.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Evan, if I can.
Unlikely.
Yeah, Evan, if I can challenge you on one point, one small point. Let's see if you think that authoritarian leaders, at least, their systems have a certain advantage. Let me quote the World Health Organization calling China's actions, quote, perhaps the most ambitious, agile, and aggressive disease containment in history.
Well, that argument is only true to a certain extent, because you have to remember it was precisely because of the authoritarian nature of China's system that they were so slow to initially react to this. People, so lower-level Chinese Communist Party bureaucrats were terrified of reporting this up their chain of command because they would be punished for failing to have public hygiene regimes and so forth. And so, yeah, I suppose authoritarian systems can respond to this with a bruter force, if that's a word, than democratic societies. But you have to remember, there's serious endemic problems with authoritarianism itself in being able to respond to these things. So I don't think it gives you overall much of an edge. You would still be better off in a free democracy.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at, I think, what we consider free democracies, for instance, South Korea, Taiwan, attacking this epidemic, their democracies, Wayne, not really inefficient or hampered by political division, right?
Oh, they've done very well. And I think the advantage of democracy, and I think Evan was moving in this direction, is democracies are much more transparent than authoritarian governments are. So information circulates much more quickly within democracies. So when a problem develops, that people will know about it, and then there's a greater incentive to respond to the problem if you know what the problem actually is. And there, I think, democracies have an advantage.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Mary is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. You know, you're talking about authoritarian governments. All of these people are Trump's buddies. And so we had better look out for the United States and what's happening to us. And then about Venezuela, and the people are suffering. They're suffering because of U.S. sanctions. They want to be socialists. That's their business. We have no right to sanction them and make them suffer. And as for China, Trump has issues with China. And if China knows how to solve this problem, we had better follow him.
Okay, Mary in Iowa City. Reaction to that, Evan, any of the Mary's comments?
Well, I think it's correct, especially when you talk about the sanctions with Venezuela, or sanctions as a tool for any crisis in international relations. The negative effect of sanctions is always on the civilian population, especially the poor civilian population. So whether it was sanctions against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, that was really hurting the average Iraqi civilian far more than Saddam Hussein and his cronies. And that holds true today with Venezuela or North Korea or Cuba. It's just that's sort of the sanctions, a very blunt instrument in IR.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, let me ask you about this. Back to our conversation, this theme, this list of authoritarian leaders going for what we'll say is kind of a power grab, using the COVID epidemic to silence critics, to consolidate power. What implications do you see there for U.S. foreign policy? We've been having so many, as you both pointed out, so many countries before the COVID crisis moving in autocratic direction.
Well, unfortunately, President Trump seems most comfortable dealing with autocratic leaders, and he has not done much up until the moment to sort of reduce U.S. support for these leaders. I mean, he's welcomed the Prime Minister or President of Hungary to the White House. He's welcomed the President of Turkey to the White House. There are national interests sometimes why you want to deal with these people, but I don't think the current administration has sent any messages that it's having difficulty dealing with these people, which I think strengthens their authoritarian efforts.
Mm-hmm. Another aspect, Evan, you pointed us to, I really wanted to have your views on this, that in the news we've been seeing U.S. intelligence officials have told the White House for weeks that China has vastly understated the spread of the coronavirus and the damage the pandemic has done. Comment on that. So how should we view the news coming out of China that they have this thing? Well, it's tailing off now. At least they have it under control.
Well, maybe. Yeah. The problem with numbers from China is that there is no free press. And so it's whatever the government is saying. And so there really is no idea whether, as to the veracity of those statements, which is why you currently have the CIA running around central China trying to figure out, actually going to morgues and counting people and trying to figure out what the actual toll is and how this is actually spreading, because there's a lot of epidemiological data that could be gleaned from China if the government would allow that data out in an uncensored way.
Mm-hmm. As a former intelligence analyst for the U.S. Air Force, you said CIA agents in China all over. Would you wager a guess on how many CIA are there trying to figure this out? Do you have data that has been reported on?
No, that would be something that would be highly classified. So I have no idea about numbers like that, no.
But you're sure it is happening?
Well, it was reported in the New York Times.
Oh, okay.
That, so it's Helene Cooper has and Dave Sanger have these contacts in D.C. that are clearly saying, you know, they're not going to give hard numbers like that. But this is an example of the links that the U.S. government is going to in order to actually get down to the nitty-gritty of the facts, the actual epidemiological data of this outbreak.
And that has a bearing on us in the United States? Connect the dot.
Well, absolutely, because then you can start to map more accurately the radius of how this spreads. You can go back and reverse engineer the genetic data, which we're already doing pretty well. And you can see how long, once you have it, are you then immune? Or if you are, for how long? I mean, these are all questions that China would be most apt to have the data on because they've had the most experience with it to date.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, and then, of course, we go back to our president referring to this new coronavirus as the Chinese virus. I don't know. He seems to have stopped saying that, or does he continue? Do you know?
I haven't heard him use the term in the last few days, but there's an underlying problem here. And again, gets back to the blame shifting argument, but sort of by playing it up, it's coming from China. It's really all China's fault. China then is doing exactly the reverse and saying it's all the Americans' fault. The American response is totally inadequate. So it itself is working to increase the tensions between nations. And then there's some conspiracies on both sides that mad scientists in China or mad scientists in the United States came up with this thing, which then are inflicting on the other side. So this is not at all good for international relations.
Mm-hmm. Evan, we have a minute or so left. In reading reports recently, though, it seems that the China and the U.S., the leaders have sort of a detente here, both countries ratcheting back the criticism of each other. Do you know what's behind that?
Well, these things ebb and flow. So, yeah, I mean, on one day it could be a little bit of detente, and the next day you're going to see a heated tweet. There's no way to predict. You know, I think Russia is probably sitting back and they're going to be running these cyber operations with these conspiracy theories just to destabilize any potential detente with China and the U.S. It's very important from Russia's foreign policy perspective to ensure that the U.S. and China stay at odds. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing for Russia would be if China and the U.S. were able to make friends after all of this.
Mm-hmm. We have just over a minute left. Leave us with some final thoughts, something that hasn't been mentioned, or add to something. Wayne, may I start with you?
Yes. Back to the investigators general. One of the things that comes to my mind, I'll go all the way back to World War II with defense spending and watching what the government was doing. A committee was created in the U.S. Senate under Senator Harry Truman to investigate defense spending, and it was brilliantly successful. It was a bipartisan committee and saved the government millions of dollars. And I'm wondering whether such a committee would be very appropriate now.
Evan Renfro, your final thoughts.
Well, I would agree. I just would wonder how you could make the committee if the president was appointing and firing these people at will. See, if there was one final thought, I guess it would be to have the listeners pay attention to what goes on with these inspector generals. These are the ethics watchdogs of the United States government. And when you see them being fired left and right like this, you pay attention to that.
Evan Renfro, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. As always, Evan and Wayne, we appreciate your expertise and your insights so much, especially during this crisis. Be well. Take care, Wayne and Evan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be with you.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, I'll be talking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial writer of the Times in western Iowa, the Storm Lake Times. It slipped me there just a moment. I hope you'll tune in for another edition of River to River.